Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway for Friday, November 17th, 2017.
These harasser propositions such as, are you going to be a good girl? To perpetrators exposing their genitals, to victims having their private parts grabbed on the House floor.
The Speaker of the House asked me if I brought my knee pads to work when I asked if he could help me get my bill out of committee.
And the young staffer is a young woman and was greeted with a member in a towel who then invited her in. At that point, he decided to expose himself. That kind of situation, what are we doing here for women right now who are dealing with somebody like that?
Congresswoman Jackie Speier of California, Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, and Congresswoman Barbara Comstock of Virginia, two Democratic women and a Republican, relaying that for them, professional politics has been what Speier calls a breeding ground for a hostile work environment for far too long. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick with you on this Friday. And this week, sexual harassment and assault by politicians, current, former, or in the running, has been at the front and center of our national conversation. More women described sexual misconduct by Senate candidate Roy Moore in Alabama. And yesterday, new allegations about a sitting senator, Al Franken.
He stuck his tongue down my mouth, and I remember I pushed him off with my hands. And I just remember I almost punched him, so because every time I see him now, like my hands clench into fists, and I'm sure that's probably why.
That's broadcaster Leanne Tweeden relaying her account of being forcibly kissed by Al Franken in 2006, before he was a Democratic senator from Minnesota, and then of him groping her while she was sleeping. Al Franken released a statement of apology the Senate Ethics Committee is now investigating. But in Congress and outside, sexual harassment has a long history and a sordid home in politics. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is Washington correspondent for The New York Times, and she's here with some perspective and some history. Cheryl, welcome back.
Thank you, Todd.
Cheryl, you wrote about a year ago about why sexual harassment seems to be a grim and persistent part of politics. You've been watching more allegations unfold this week along with the rest of us. What have you been thinking about?
Well, I think politics is kind of a unique profession or environment, a unique place for a breeding ground, as the Congresswoman called it, for a couple of reasons. One, politics tends to attract young people. So young women and also young men who are sometimes victimized come into this arena that's filled with power. And we know that sexual harassment and sexual assault are a lot more about power than about sex. And secondly, in politics, the organization rises and falls around a central figure. So if you're being sexually harassed in a company, maybe the harasser can get fired and the problem goes away. But in politics, if you're talking about an elected official, the voters put that official in place, and the whole organization depends upon the continued success of that one individual at the center. So if I'm a young woman and I report that I'm being harassed, I could not only lose my job if the person's political career goes down the tubes, but all my colleagues could lose their jobs as well.
What you're talking about is sort of a perfect storm of power and hierarchy that makes politics a ripe environment for sexual harassment. Cheryl, and I'll add into that you and me, the media glare on politics that has an enforced code of silence when harassment starts in the first place.
I think that's true. And I should also say that reporters, actually, who work in political environments are not exempt. For my story, I interviewed but didn't quote a young reporter at the State House in Albany. And she complained to me that when she was attending a press conference, after the press conference was over, a lawmaker there pushed her to the corner of the room, sort of, you know, walked her into the corner of the room and then reached out and grabbed her from behind, right there in full view of all the people who are standing around.
Cheryl, you and I covered Capitol Hill for many years, side by side. I want to tell you that I've experienced advances from both male and female members of Congress at work. I confess I never perceived it as much of a threat, and I still don't. Everybody's different. But in the age of iPhones, women journalists on Capitol Hill lament all the time about how late-night texts, sometimes inappropriate calls or texts from members, are a cost of having cell phone access to the people they cover. Not in all cases, but in many.
That's especially true, I think, here in Congress, because people who come to Congress are far away from their families, right? So it's an environment where people do tend to work late at night, and men and women are away from home. You know, they're living here as sort of a free-for-all atmosphere in the, you know, in the evenings. And I think that's also maybe a part of this culture that you're describing. I think I know a lot of people who've experienced, if not advances, sort of untoward comments or just behavior that wouldn't be viewed as appropriate in any other workplace.
Let's talk a little bit how the culture of sexual harassment in politics has changed, though. We're in a moment of revelation now in this country. Some of it's reactionary. I think reactionary to an era of non-accountability before this. But we can go back, Cheryl, as far as we like into the history of non-accountability for this behavior in politics. But it seems like, to me, the rise and the career and the presidency of Bill Clinton is a great place to start a reckoning about the modern era of sexual harassment and assault.
He sat down, pulled down his pants, and he was exposed. And I said, I'm not that kind of girl.
The next thing I knew, he had me backed into a corner. And, you know, hands all over me, trying to kiss me, whispering in my ear.
And then as he points over my shoulder, he grabs me and turns me to him. And I kept telling him no, and he wouldn't listen.
Cheryl, it seems like this country, well, really, it seems like Democrats and liberals are just beginning to reckon with the accusations and the behaviors of Bill Clinton.
Yes, that's true. You know, Democrats and liberals really gave Bill Clinton a pass. I think their thinking back in the 90s was, well, he's been a good president for women's rights, so let's kind of shut our eyes to these allegations against him. But we know that sexual assault and sexual harassment know no political bounds. And Democrats are starting to open their eyes to reckon with what Bill Clinton was accused of. We saw just last night, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand said in an interview with The Times that Bill Clinton should have resigned over his affair with Monica Lewinsky. I think that's a first, a sitting Democratic senator saying now that the former Democratic president was unfit to serve because of his treatment of a young woman.
Yeah, and Cheryl, President Trump last night tweeted mockingly about Al Franken, without irony, I'll add. A president who's had no fewer than 10 women accusing him of sexual harassment and assault, and who bragged about how easy it was for him to kiss and grope women whenever he wanted. We're all familiar with it.
Yeah, this is really the pot calling the kettle black, Todd. And I guess I'm wondering, as we're having this reckoning with, as you said, people like Bill Clinton and now Al Franken on the Democratic side, and Republicans are having their own reckoning with Roy Moore, Republicans in Washington calling him unfit to serve, when is that reckoning going to happen with the man in the White House? You know, President Trump, as you said, admitted on tape that he grabbed women by the crotch.
How easy is it to report sexual harassment on Capitol Hill right now?
You know, it's not that easy. There's this convoluted system that requires counseling. Women have to go to something called the women and men, I should say, men are victims too, and we shouldn't forget that, have to go to something called the Office of Compliance. And once they report something, there's a mandatory period, I think, of 30 days of counseling. They're required to go through mediation, and it all has to be kept secret. So it's a system that was set up by Congress to apply only to Congress, and it's really not that easy to report and to see through a claim.
Cheryl, there's no question that we're at a remarkable moment, and maybe a moment of accountability on Capitol Hill and outside. But you and I both know there are a lot of very, very powerful people in that building who would like nothing more than for this conversation to go away so they can talk about almost anything else. What are the chances here, do you think, for real change to this culture on Capitol Hill that's sustainable?
Well, we are seeing some steps. The Senate has instituted now mandatory sexual harassment training. I believe the House is doing the same. I think the first step toward change in any culture is to talk about it. And at least we're talking about it. Whether there'll be changes that are sustainable, I don't know. I'm taking a big breath here because, you know, politics is politics. The conditions that we've described, the idea that young people are attracted to the profession, that it's a profession that involves power, those things aren't going to change. So what's got to change is the willingness of people to speak up about it and the willingness of those in power to condemn these kinds of acts.
Veteran reporter and Washington correspondent for The New York Times, Cheryl Gay Stolberg. Cheryl, it's always good to have you.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be here.
Well, all this week, we've heard so many stories from you, our listeners, stories of sexual assault and harassment. Here are just a few.
I've had an employer comment that I shouldn't get pregnant. I've had an employer comment that they preferred me single. I've had a coworker comment about my success in the court case I was involved in, that the outcome was largely influenced by my appearance. The judge undoubtedly favored me because I'm quote-unquote hot.
Hi, I'm calling anonymously from Chicago. I never reported sexual harassment from my boss because when I was young, and I guess I thought this is just the way things are in the workplace, he was gay, and I didn't see sexual harassment as power at that time, and I do now. So even though he would show me sexually explicit pictures or make incredibly inappropriate comments, since he wasn't attracted to me, I guess I didn't consider it harassment. And now that I've been in a different workplace, and I know that's not just status quo, I do see it as a power move.
We're hearing your stories, and this next one is especially disturbing.
My name is Carol. I'm calling from Hillsborough, New Jersey. I was sexually harassed by a high school English teacher. He came into the library where I was studying, and at the time, I didn't understand what he actually did, but as I became older, I realized that he actually sat across from the large wooden table, and as I was writing and studying, he started masturbating, and the table was going up and down. So I was so embarrassed, I didn't tell the library attendant, I didn't tell my parents, and I took my books and I left. But I was mortified, and of course I had to go back to class the next day, and it was not something that I felt comfortable talking about.
We're hearing from so many of you with your personal stories of sexual harassment and sexual assault. And we want to thank the many of you who've chosen to share your stories with us. I also want to say that we listen to each and every call and read each and every text and Facebook post that we get, even the ones that don't make it to the air. We are here to listen on this show, and your role in giving your voice to the show is the most important thing to us. We're always at 8778-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
Thanks for being with us on The Takeaway on this Friday. I'm Todd Zwillick, and we have a story now about a troubling trend in American preschools. When it comes to disciplining kids as young as 3 years old, many pre-Ks choose to suspend them. New national data on public and private preschools shows that in 2016, an estimated 50,000 preschoolers across the country were suspended at least once, and an estimated 17,000 were expelled. That's according to the Center for American Progress. They're a liberal research and advocacy group. Tanette Powell is a PhD candidate in education at UCLA and the mother of three young boys, two of them who were just 3 and 4 years old when they were suspended multiple times.
JJ, who is the oldest of my three sons, he was suspended about 3 times. And Joa, who was 3 at the time and is my middle child, he was suspended multiple times for either throwing a toy or hitting a staff member. And there, when it came to hitting a staff member, again, he was 3. They would tell me that even though he didn't like hit them hard, because he made the swiping motion, he had to be sent home.
A 3-year-old.
A 3-year-old.
I spoke to Tanette along with Rashid Malik. He's a policy analyst at the Center for American Progress. And Tanette says the suspensions concerned her as a parent, while her young kids couldn't even understand the punishment that administrators were doling out.
When I first got the phone call, I was just like, oh my gosh, I failed, right? Like all the things that, you know, my husband and I put into parenting, all the things that we thought we were doing well. We thought we had brilliant kids who were well behaved with the exception of being 3 and 4 and, you know, and doing things and trying to navigate the world. So it was very difficult for me. There was one time I was talking to an administrator and we were talking about Joa, who was 3 at the time, and they referred to him as a danger. And to this day, I still have a hard time trying to block that out of my head.
Rashid Malik, I want to bring you in here. As you listen to Tanette's story of her children and her interaction with the teachers and administrators at school, you're someone who studied this from afar. What are you hearing?
The rough play, the testing of boundaries, this is all very typical developmentally appropriate behavior for a 3 or a 4-year-old. And it's now widely recognized that its suspensions are ineffective across the board for older children as well. But for preschoolers, this practice can be even more damaging because this is their entry point to the educational system, to a structured learning environment. And children internalize this criticism, and their parents internalize it, as Tanette described.
Let's talk some numbers here. What do we know about how prevalent suspensions and expulsions for very young children are? I saw one number that said about 50,000 preschoolers were suspended at least once in 2016. There's a population of preschoolers in America of about 8 million. So that would say less than 1%. Is that number high? Should the number be 0? What do we know?
The number that you're citing, the 50,000 suspensions, as well as about 15,000 expulsions in 2016, that's a new number that we were able to pull out of the recent National Survey of Children's Health, and it shows that it's a much bigger problem than we previously understood. The 3 risk factors for a preschooler being expelled are what have been described as the 3 Bs, and that's boys, black, and big. So there is a well-established research showing that adults consistently perceive young black boys as being older than they are, and that their behavior is often perceived as more dangerous or problematic. And so this is perhaps another instance of the kind of pathologizing of black childhood.
I mean, it almost gets me teary-eyed because I'm thinking to myself, like, wow, that is, when you break it down, those 3 Bs are what is divided by. And so it makes you feel a little bit hopeless.
How good are the data to let us know if this perception, this sort of branding, if you like, of very, very small children with a racial component starts as young as 3 years old?
We're kind of at the frontier of understanding how preschool suspensions affect children long term. There's certainly, psychologists understand that this type of rejection can be potentially scarring for children, and it's certainly not best practices for a preschool learning environment. But we're starting to raise consciousness around this, and there are many researchers and advocates trying to get this information into the hands of administrators and preschool teachers so that they can really tackle this issue.
Tanette, you're one of them. You've been at work trying to come up with alternatives to suspension for children as young as 3 or 4. What has that work been like?
You know, as we talk about these numbers and we say less than 1%, while that might not seem a lot, that's tens of thousands of families that have to deal with this, right? For me, you know, I decided that this had to become my life's work because no longer could I allow myself to just sit around and watch this happening to other families. And so my research interviews black parents about this very topic to see, like, what are the scars of suspension? What does this look like? What is the impact? Because I think so long in our society, we have dehumanized black people. And a part of this process, if we want to change this course and we want to be able to allow black kids to just simply be kids, then it starts with writing about these parents' stories more, and really, really humanizing the narrative and humanizing what's happening all around the country.
Rashid, before we go, you know, all of this just makes me think about an American cliche, right? The problem child.
We've all heard that before. Mm-hmm. I don't think I had an idea before talking to the two of you that that designation can start as early as 3 years old.
Children of this age are testing out their environment. They're understanding themselves and their place in the world. They are very innocent and deserve our nurturing, caring attention. And so, you know, this is an opportunity for us to evaluate how we are caring for and educating our young children. And it's just a shame that these studies that we use to justify public investment in preschool, then we turn around and find a way to systematically exclude Black children.
And when we see this happening, it does not attack any of the historical narrative about Black kids. So as you bring up problem child, I think about W.E.B. Du Bois and Soul of Black Folks when he said, how does it feel to be a problem? And Black people, including children, have historically been a problem in this society. And I feel like this historical aspect and historical reality that has been so present and dominant has to be addressed.
Tynette Powell, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Rashid Malik, thanks to you as well.
Thanks so much.
Tynette Powell, a mother of three and PhD candidate in education at UCLA, and Rashid Malik, policy analyst at the Center for American Progress.
Really, deep down inside, we're all cats, right?
General Sterling Fry.
Mr. Bigglesworth gets upset.
But you're a cat.
A Cheshire cat.
I'm a cat. You're a mouse. You should be living in a hole.
Well, you're a cat whisperer, and I'm pretty sure I'm still a cat.
Very good.
Oh, it's an all-cat movie montage at the top of our Friday movie segment. Hi, Obi, my cat. Are you listening at home? Probably not. It's Friday. Rafer Guzman is here with from Newsday, our movie critic. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Say hi to Obi, would you?
Hi, Obi.
There, he's not listening.
Good
Don't
kidding.
Worry about it. We got two movies, Rafer. We're going to talk about Justice League with all of your superhero friends, and also Wonder, which is a new film out from director Stephen Chbosky. I got a little trivia for you, if you like. Let's not answer now, but I'll give you this one. You got to get this one. We're talking about Justice League. Rafer, I'll put it to you very simply. Who is Superman's father? Take that one.
All right.
About it. I think you're nodding. You might know this one. Let's talk about Justice League. Now, look, this is Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Cyborg, and don't forget the Flash, right? Together again.
That's right.
Here's a clip.
You're the Batman?
So you're fast.
That feels like an oversimplification.
I'm putting together a team. People with special abilities. You see, I believe enemies are coming.
Stop right there. I'm in.
You are?
Yeah. I need friends.
This is Justice League. There was a time when we called them the Super Friends, Rafer. How's this one?
That's right. The old Hanna-Barbera days, I think that was, Tom.
Yeah.
I think you can hear in that clip an attempt to go for the kind of serious slash funny tone that the Marvel movies, I think, do so well. DC is always, I think, trying to get on that kind of bandwagon, and it just doesn't work this time. That was Ezra Miller as The Flash, Ben Affleck as Batman, of course. I don't know, something about the DC universe to me that just has not come to life on screen. And after Wonder Woman, which was such a great, funny, smart, fresh movie, it's such a disappointment to see her sort of thrown into this mix with all these other superheroes. She gets really sidelined. Nobody's that fun. The new characters aren't that interesting. And I'm sorry to say it, Justice League just seemed like one more DC movie to me. Not a lot of fun, not very entertaining.
And especially on the heels of the success of Wonder Woman and Gal Gadot, that's a disappointment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think the last one, Batman versus Superman, was a big moneymaker. This one might be too.
Let's talk about Wonder, which is a new film, as I said, from director Stephen Chbosky. A story about a young man with some facial differences. People might call them deformities. Listen.
Two rules. First, only raise your hand once a class, no matter how many answers you know, except for science. Crush the wall.
Check.
Second, you're going to feel like you're all alone, Augie, but you're not.
I hear Owen Wilson there.
That's right, playing the parent of Augie Pullman, and that's Jacob Tremblay from Room, who plays Augie. Mm. And as you said, he's got facial differences. It's not specified in the film or in the book on which the film is based, but I think it's supposed to be, or people think it's Treacher-Collins syndrome, which results in a very particular kind of alteration of the face. And he has to attend his first middle school. He's been homeschooled all his life. Now he's in fifth grade, and he's going out to face the real world. And I was a big fan of the book. I loved the book. I think the movie is a really great, sensitive adaptation of the book. Jacob Tremblay, of course, is just a natural-born heart-tugger. Julia Roberts plays the mother. Great cast. I really like the message of this film, which is it doesn't really cost that much to sort of make a little room for someone who's different. It doesn't really cost that much to be tolerant, be kind, and accept someone for who they are. And I know that's a corny thing to say, but it seems like a message worth hearing at this particular moment in time. And I think the movie is really good. It works really well.
That's wonder. Rafer, let's get back to trivia before I let you go. Justice League, I asked you, who is Superman's father?
I'm assuming Jor-El.
He knows who the father of Superman is. Jor-El. J-O-R hyphen... Yeah.
Thanks, John Hodgman. You got it, Rafer.
Thanks,
Rafer Guzman,
Don.
Newsday. On Thursday in Zimbabwe, envoys from South Africa held talks with the detained President Robert Mugabe and his army chief in an effort to form a consensus on the military coup that was launched there earlier this week. Mugabe is 93. He's ruled Zimbabwe since independence from Britain in 1980. He was under house arrest for several days after the coup began, although today Robert Mugabe made his first public appearance at a graduation ceremony in Zimbabwe's capital, Harare. The next few days and weeks, though, will set the stage for the next chapter in Zimbabwe's history. So what should we expect? Todd Moss is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. Todd, thanks for being here.
Great to talk to you, Todd.
Well, what have you seen in this transition so far? Look, military coups are probably never a good thing. Zimbabwe appears to be endeavoring to have a relatively peaceful and bloodless one.
Well, coups are always confusing, especially in the first hours and days. A lot of misinformation, a lot of theater, actually. And that's exactly what we're seeing in Zimbabwe. So it clearly is a coup. The president was under house arrest. The army's controlling the TV station, the airport. They've been rounding up corrupt cabinet ministers. It's all the classic signs of a coup. And we were expecting yesterday that some kind of deal would be struck between the military and Mugabe for him to give a veneer of legality here, which would be he would resign and agree to leave the country. And it looks like they've gotten stuck on when that would happen.
Robert Mugabe is 93 years old. Waiting in the wings is the former vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, who's a youthful 75. What do we know about him?
Emmerson Mnangagwa is a longtime right-hand man of Robert Mugabe. He was with him during the Liberation War in the 1970s. He was his security chief for many years. And he's very, very tight with the military. And the precipitation of the coup is that he was fired and forced to leave the country. The coup is the military pushing back against Mugabe, saying, no, we want Emmerson Mnangagwa back. We do not want Robert Mugabe's wife, First Lady Grace Mugabe, to be the next president.
What about Mnangagwa's reputation inside Zimbabwe? I've been doing a little bit of research and had read he was head of the secret police in the early 80s and presided over some crackdowns that left tens of thousands of people dead.
That's right. He was the architect of a crackdown in the southern part of the country in the 1980s, which left at least 20,000 civilians dead. He has never been held to account for that. He doesn't even admit that that happened, but the evidence is very clear. So he is not the future of Zimbabwe.
But he may be, right? If Emmerson Mnangagwa winds up taking power, are Zimbabweans in for a future of autocracy and more crackdowns?
You know, there is a scenario where Zimbabwe has a military junta headed by Mnangagwa running the country. I don't think that that is sustainable for very long. The country is literally out of cash. The region would not put up with that. The economy is still relatively reliant on South Africa. They could put pressure on a military government if that's what happened. So I think that there will be some kind of negotiated settlement and that hopefully, in a best-case scenario, will lead to free and fair elections next year.
You know, a lot of analysts, diplomats, people like you, Todd, have been spending the last 10, 15 years watching China and watching China make moves into the region, investing heavily in natural resources, making new contacts with governments in southern and central Africa. Does China have an influence here?
Sure. China is a relatively large investor in Zimbabwe. Both the general who organized the coup and Emmerson Mnangagwa were both trained in China, so they have longstanding ties there. So China is influential. It will be influential. And I think that provides a stark contrast for the United States because, you know, the American reputation around the world is in jeopardy. The world does not know if the United States still stands for democracy and human rights. And Zimbabwe, this is a perfect example where the United States can stand up for human rights and for democracy and help to improve our own image while helping a country come back from the brink.
Todd Moss is former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, also author of the book Minute Zero, a diplomatic thriller all about the fall of a dictator in Zimbabwe. Todd Moss, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Todd. Great to be with you.
I'm Todd Zwillick with you here on The Takeaway, and here's a healthcare story now. No, not from Congress, not from the Senate floor where the individual mandate is in jeopardy yet again. No, this American healthcare story is from the world of literature back in the 1950s. Legendary detective novelist and screenwriter Raymond Chandler is known for films and books like The Big Sleep and many others, but he also apparently had healthcare on his mind. That's according to a new discovery from Andrew Gooley. Andrew has been responsible for unearthing unknown stories from lots of authors, including H.G. Wells, and now he's found a previously unpublished short story from Raymond Chandler as well. It's called It's All Right, He Only Died, and it's a story that shows that Raymond Chandler had a lot of ideas about equity and justice in healthcare that could have put him right in the center of the debate today. Story sleuth Andrew Gooley is managing editor of The Strand magazine. He says this story led him to, of all places, a shoebox.
Well, this one was housed in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. And the interesting thing is the finding aids had this scribbled note saying that a lot of these items were brought over in the 90s and they were found in a shoebox. So to all those people out there, please do not neglect shoeboxes because you may find treasures in them. And this story, I was very surprised to find it because I thought that everything that Chandler had ever written was published. And I asked the librarian at the Bodleian to send me a copy of this because I was working with him for over a month and he would send me copies of things and I would find out that they were published. So I did not have much hope, but when I opened up the envelope, I still acted like Gaspar Gutman from the Maltese Falcon saying, 17 years I've waited for this.
Well, look, fans of Raymond Chandler, they know him from The Long Goodbye, The Big Sleep, lots of detective novels, some of which have been made into famous films. Does this newly uncovered story, It's All Right, He Only Died, will that remind him of the work that they love?
In some ways it will, and in some ways it won't. It will in the fact that it has Chandler's trademark prose, which is very tight, very quick. You know, Chandler does not play around with descriptions of sunsets for a long time or talking about people's Mephistophelian eyebrows. He gets to the point, he gets off the ground running, and this story does have this style of Chandler. However, it's not a detective story. This is a story that has a social message attached to it where this transient, as he's called in the story, is found drunk with a head injury, and he finds himself in an emergency room where the hospital staff is very, very reluctant to treat somebody who they suspect may not be able to pay them for their services.
Dr. Williams looked at the clock. 7:10. This was his case, if he wanted it. He thought of his home, the good dinner already spoiled. Why couldn't these last-minute accidents be decent cases? Still, the man could be badly hurt. That would be at least $25 worth of x-rays. Calling out the technician, then the damn lab fees, another $10. Then the ward rates on top of that. I'll never get paid, thought Dr. Williams. Still, he leaned over and could smell whiskey. Williams started to take his coat off.
I'm sure he's just drunk, Doctor,
Iris said.
And he hasn't a dime. Why did the police bring him here? How can we run the hospital? You know how Mr. Brownell feels about it.
Pretty much a postcard-sized indictment of the healthcare industry.
Exactly, and it's quite uncommon in that Chandler had an author's note at the end of the story where he sort of rails against physicians who would not treat people who they suspected would not reimburse them. And that's interesting coming from Chandler, and I suspect that his several hospital stays influence the story, because in the 50s he was thrown into county hospital after what he called one of the most inept suicide attempts ever. And he was also in the hospital in New York City because when he was drunk, he had fallen off some stairs. So he had a first-eye view of the healthcare system in the United States. And I think he was forecasting how difficult it would be for people of very humble means to get healthcare. Or he was probably just looking at patients and thinking to himself, a doctor or hospital's decision might be influenced by the fact that their patient would not have insurance and would be unable to pay them.
Which is a dynamic that's been proven in research time and again since then, that ability to pay does affect the quality of care. So he was prescient in that way. Andrew, are there any other instances from Raymond Chandler's career where he lashed out about social issues or had a social conscience?
In a lot of his works, he has this sort of a theme where whatever shines is definitely not gold. So amidst all the wealthy people and the oligarchs in Los Angeles, when you dig under the surface, you find people that are very decayed and very corrupt. And in Chandler's view, big money corrupted people. But the backdrop to which he started writing detective stories were his experiences as an oil executive in the 20s and 30s. And during that time, you could call that the golden age of corruption in Los Angeles. In fact, his own boss was fired from his job for embezzling money from the oil company. So there's a lot of that sort of view in Chandler's books where money corrupts people. And the story carries along the same theme of how a person's health care might be influenced if they afforded to pay a hospital that was depending upon a wealthy benefactor to keep the place afloat.
Well, Andrew Gooley, it's another great find in your story detective series. I have to say that. Raymond Chandler's long gone. I wonder if you think he might be gratified if 535 members of Congress having a healthcare debate each got a copy of the Strand magazine so they could read his story.
I think they should get a copy. The world of healthcare has influenced me personally because both of my parents passed away, my dad in 1990 and my mom in 1997. And, they were fortunate to be covered by insurances, and we had the means to take care of them. But what if they did not have any insurance? What if they did not have a safety net to make sure that they were treated well? And I remember talking to my mom, and my mom was once saying, the United States is such a wealthy country that nobody should be suffering for lack of health care. And when you see how people today have been delaying treatment because they're afraid that insurance will not cover any of their diseases or any prevention, it's disheartening. So I do wish that every member of Congress could have a chance to read this story and get a better insight into how less fortunate people have to cope today.
Lawmakers, if you're listening, the Strand magazine is available, and it's in the Library of Congress right across the street from where you're working. So take heart. Andrew Gooley is the managing editor of the Strand magazine. Andrew, thanks.
Thanks a lot, Todd. Always great to be with you.
And we leave you today with this bit of news. We spent a lot of time last winter covering the protests against an oil pipeline in Standing Rock, North Dakota, where Standing Rock Sioux tribe members were worried about oil leaks contaminating their water. Well, yesterday, another pipeline that runs through the Dakotas, the Keystone Pipeline, leaked more than 200,000 gallons of oil into the ground near Amherst, South Dakota. The pipeline's owner, TransCanada, said the leak was isolated and sealed within 15 minutes. The controversial Keystone XL pipeline is the planned sister pipeline from that same company. The Trump administration allowed that pipeline to move forward with the decision back in March. We always want to hear from you on anything that you hear on our show, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can tweet us at The Takeaway. Have a great weekend, everyone, and thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.